has been way too long. Like, I didn't do a single thing for Lent, I don't think. Which is horrible. I missed half of Pentecost, too. And I missed Easter itself. So let's fix that right here, right now. Because it's kind of a big thing, isn't it? Yeah. So that's a joke today. The joke's all me. Anyway, guess what?
There are Jews in the world. There are Buddhists. There are Hindus and Mormons and them. There are those that follow Mohammed's, but I've never been one of them.
Fie Jesu Domine, dona eis requiem.
Oh Lord, oh you are so big, so absolutely huge.
Do you think maybe he's compensating for something?
Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah.
What did we learn?
I don't know, sir.
I don't fucking know either.
All right. So very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, the women went to that tomb. And they had been saying to one another, "Who's going to roll that stone away so that we can get in?" And when they looked up, they saw the stone, big-ass stone, already been rolled back. Rocks. I'm actually right here in front of Menards, and I'm telling you something that's kind of crazy. They actually have a sale going on for rocks and concrete blocks, evidently. I just saw that sign. I'm not talking about pebbles or pea gravel. I'm talking about boulders. They got like four of them sitting here in the parking lot. And the price tag, I drove by, they're not cheap. But one stone, I mean, I'm from Las Vegas, so rocks are our thing. But wouldn't just like this big stone in your yard kind of like look fantastic? Be in the playground too, kids climbing all over it, breaking their arms and shit. A rock to fit your landscaping. Evidently, they're on sale right now. You might even kind of consider like a special monolith for your living room or den, you know, just a limestone or sandstone pole, pillar, four sides, maybe some scribbly, fakey hieroglyphs or something. Make it look artistic. Believe it or not, ornamental rocks, when they sell, I looked it up before I started this, they go for millions. It's an entire industry. Some of these granite gems are harvested from 23,000 boulder-rich acres in Sierra Nevada. In the foothills of the Sierra Nevadas. Kind of close to where I was from. And they're shipped to anyone willing to pay for a big rock. In fact, there's this artist, Kim Touros, and out in California. It's her business to locate just the right rock for you. Just like a calming permanence when you see that weight sitting there. That's what she says, at least. I mean, it was written, but a calming permanence? A huge rock for relaxation therapy. Now, this group of ladies we got in our reading from Mark's Easter story, they stood at that big rock. And it did nothing to relax them. There is that permanence, though. A rock trophy, a monument to the enemy's power of destruction and death. Because that's the enemy. The end. So who's going to roll that stone away? That rock that blocked the entrance to the tomb, denying access to Jesus, whom they came to anoint and embalm, well, not embalm, but, you know, wrap and do all the good things with that they do in preparation for the body to sit there. You know, rot. to the women on that sad sunrise, that journey to the borrowed tomb of Joseph Arimathea, that rock was profoundly disturbing. The rock, soon to be the anchor of their resurrection faith, was at that moment a bitter and unyielding witness to death's power. That rock was a symbol of death's constant relentlessness and its stubborn pursuit of all mankind. Even Jesus, yeah, even Jesus, that Lord of life, was dead. And Jesus, though he walked through the valley of Zalmavet, you know, the shadow of death from Psalm 23, verse 4, that rock was rolled to the entrance of the borrowed tomb, all light, all hope. It was shut off, folks. That stone bore testimony to that permanence, that finality, that unchanging moment of death. The rock guarded the grave's blackness. It preserved the bleakness of that crypt. Because death ruled, all bow to Baron Samedi. King Crypt is the end, and all must face him. Its shadow was lengthened to cover even Jesus. Or at least so it would have seemed to the women that first Easter morning. Death hadn't taken into its rocky jaws even the Lord. They had heard proclaim, "I am the resurrection and the life." That rock, menacing, threatening, ominous, unmovable, dead. Who's going to roll that rock away for us? It gathers up this mournful inquiry for the whole universe, doesn't it? Or at least out of the whole universe. These ladies seem to have put into language the great sigh of universal manhood. Who's going to roll the stone away? And philosophy joined that quest to peer beyond the rock for hope, some glimmer of light. And religion, yeah, it ventured to penetrate that dark empire with light. But that rock survives. A relentless obstruction to peace. Now, excuse my yawn, there's been cults of every hue that have come and gone attempting to shake death's heavy stone from its moorings. Some of them, such as the mass suicide of 39 people in the Heaven's Gate cult, left tragedy in their wake, proving rather than negating death's power. And there have been rich celebrities who've, you know, more secular in mind than religious, than the cults. They don't bother with them. They sat there and decided, hey, we don't want to face that rock. So they've had the remains frozen in cryostate to be thawed when scientific knowledge has sufficiently advanced to cure the disease. Yeah, science, technology, they're part of that crusade against that awful stone from Crypt's door too. You know what, despite all the predictions and stupid fanfics people write of the day of victory when the enemy shall have been defeated and were lifted up above everything, that rock's always rolled into place. It brings fear, darkness, and that permanency. That's so awe-inspiring that everyone feels fear of it. That rock hasn't been moved by science or money. Philosophers and religion have failed to move it. No amount of skill can seem to budge it from its legitimate birth. techno wizards, techno ministers, they've all been unable to conquer this cornerstone of that grim castle. And the women were thinking to themselves that the stone was large. They were more right than they knew, weren't they? From death, from the rock, there's no escape. One of last year's most successful movies, well, what am I talking about? I just watched it. It was decades ago, anyway. Have you ever seen that movie, The Rock? When it opens, that rock is more a harmless pebble than a large stone. The prison shut down in 1963. Now it's only open as a tourist attraction for the curious. Children visit there in school outings. Tourists led up and down the foreboding cell blocks as they hear guides make the claim that there was never a successful escape from Alcatraz or the rock. That was untrue, according to the movie. One man, the hero, played by Sean Connery, had in fact been the only one to escape decades ago. In Alcatraz, that rock was going to see action again. Heavily armed terrorist group, former military, actually I think they were actually part of the military, weren't they? I think so. They had turned mercenary. They took over the former prison with chemical weapons capable of taking out the entire coast of California. And these terrorists had taken the tourists as hostage, locking them up in the very cell blocks they had come to see. Yeah, they really got the feel of what it was like to be locked up on the rock. And that's where Sean and Nicolas Cage came in. This one man who escaped from the rock so many years earlier, this one victor over the rock's boast of total victory must be found. And he has to break back into the rock to foil their evil plan, to rescue the people, escort them to safety. It's not really a bad analogy. Death's ominous rock has been captured, but by one. And that rock's defeat rendered death more a pebble than a large stone. Yeah, despite the victory, we are still hostages in the rock's grip. Despite the victory. That victory. Yeah, the rock of death remains fearful, bleak, mysterious, scary. Now that one victor, Jesus, who had broken the rock's power so long ago, must come to us to foil the plan and escort us out of the place of death, Sheol. Now, I asked the question a few moments ago, why have a rock in your living room? God meant to make a very uncommon trophy. Trophy of God's grandest victory. Death has been swallowed up in a victory. So maybe Kim Touros was right. Huge rocks have a calming permanence about them when we look at the rock with Easter eyes. The stone, so large, has already been rolled away. The horrible rock of death is now just the trophy of Christ's victory. The cornerstone of the enemy's grim and horrible castle has been toppled. Jesus lives. Blessed be my rock, and exalted be the God of my salvation. And that's just the beginning of the story, isn't it?
I don't think you understand. We got more to talk about. It's only been 13 minutes.
So where do we go? Jesus lives. Mary goes out and she finds Jesus. Didn't know it was Jesus. Just went in and dude says, you know, some guy later says, hey, you looking for Jesus? He ain't fucking here. Go tell his boys he's going to Galilee first, right? Right. So she runs, tells him. Peter and John come rushing back to find the two men. What the fuck?
And they're still scared, aren't they? Let's talk about that fear. Because let's go with a little story. Do we need a story? I don't know. But when Jesus appeared to his disciples, like we see in John 20, verses 19 through 23, we encounter some things. Hiding behind some doors. Rachel's face was seen streaked with tears. She wiped her cheeks with the back of her hand, and Rachel had been this unnamed disciple since Jesus had first visited her village. They celebrated two Passovers. It had been that long ago. Now, she probably wasn't important as, say, Simon and his brothers were. She couldn't speak eloquently, couldn't command evil spirits to disappear. She didn't carry any side of debate about religious law, and she was a woman. But Rachel called Jesus Lord. She considered her a disciple and traveled with that loyal band to Jerusalem. That meant she had been at the temple when Jesus had debated the rulers. She had been in the shadows of the upper room and in the darkness of the garden. She might have been one of the ladies who stayed when the men had left and abandoned Jesus. She watched him die on the cross. They cry out, Eloi, Eloi, sabachthani. It was too much for her, though, wasn't it? How could God do this? She must have sobbed. In the dusk of that first day of a new week, she and the other better-known disciples were learning that God was using even the shameful cross for his purpose. She was learning the power of the Spirit, the presence. There was yet work to do. Her tears of grief were becoming other tears in time. They're slowly going to become tears of joy. Now, way back during a time when boys were drafted into armed service, there was a devout young man drafted from a farm in South Georgia that was sent to the army. Now, he had never been but a few miles from his home. And he was suddenly thrust into a new, very structured environment. But as he left his home, he took with him that faith that he had and the practices that had been an important part of his life since childhood. And that meant for him such things as reading the Bible regularly, kneeling by his bed each night for a time of prayer. Now this overt sign of piety infuriated the sergeant, who was in charge of this company of recruits. He set about to deliberately humiliate the young Christian every time he got a chance. He sought to make the young man's life over into the image of hostility and brute force that the sergeant had lived. That sergeant abused that man verbally. He issued him all sorts of unfair treatment. He used every opportunity to harass that soldier. Yet at no point did that young man from Georgia resort to returning evil to evil. He endured all the abuse without a word of complaint. Again and again, however, he did find occasion to do kind things for the sergeant. One Saturday night, the sergeant came home from the barracks, three sheets to the wind. On seeing this young man kneeling by his bunk, the sergeant exploded. He shouted and tried every way he could to distract the boy. When nothing seemed to work, that sergeant took off one of his muddy, heavy boots and threw it at the boy. Sailing across the room, it hit him in the back of the head. It stunned him. He fell to the floor. In a moment, he regained his composure and, without a word, resumed his prayer by the side of his bunk. Even more enraged, the sergeant took off the other boot and flung it at the young recruit. Hit the boy again, but He didn't retaliate in anger. Then Sergeant reeled off in a string of oaths, stumbled into his own quarters into bed. Next morning, Sergeant woke up with swollen eyes, throbbing head, and the first thing he saw were his boots, cleaned, polished, sitting by his bed. And the sight was more he could take. With tears, he walked to the barracks, found the young man, and said, "What is with you? I've done everything in my power to break you instead. You've broken me. What do you know that I don't know? What's your secret? What's your power?" The young boy said, "God's spirit." I know that is a very corny story. It hurt to say it. But it's kind of the story that those soap operas you find in the afternoon are made, aren't they? At his most profound level, it's this witness to a sensed presence of God in life. The young recruit was giving witness to the unseen things that mattered in his life, those spiritual affirmations. So let's have another story that's a little bit more, and it will carry me into kind of what I want to talk about, which originally was going to be all about Thomas, but I think I've done Thomas a lot. Everyone knows that I think Thomas has gotten a poor shot. He's gotten some shit kicked out of him. I mean, the majesty people put in the scriptures, to me, kind of feels off. And my Diet Coke's all gone. Because we're sitting here talking about doubting Thomas. But he wasn't in that room that night. Or sorry, that day. See, those disciples were locked up in their room, hiding in the dark, fearful of the Jews. Probably the Romans too, come to think of it. I mean, it's the Romans who finally, like, did the dirty deed. But where was Thomas? See, Thomas wasn't there. So when Jesus arrived and saw them all fearful and said, "Peace be with you," showed his hands and his sides, and they were amazed. Regardless of the locked door, Thomas was not there. He was out among the people. That God's presence was already with him, don't you think? He didn't show that fear for the people that his other compatriots had. He wasn't like Simon or Barnabas, John and James, Rachel. He was out doing things, living his life. And don't forget, the first time we saw Tom, Judas Didius Thomas, the twin, Judas twin, as I like to point out to people, he was out getting tuna. Now, here's the thing for you ladies out there. Guys, we trash each other. We do. We are quite abusive and toxic to each other. It's how we show our love, weirdly enough. And we don't expect anything from each other because, well, all of our expectations are safe for you guys. That being said, when Tom shows up, after getting all the shit that everyone's been giving them, they're sitting there and they're saying, "Jesus appeared to us." Now, Tom had unlocked the door to get in. Jesus wouldn't have had a key. These guys have been fucking with him for the last 3 years. He was done with their shit. "Know what, assholes? When I can put my hands in his fingers in his hands and put my hand at his side, I'll fucking believe you." Now imagine for a second, though. Let's pull back the curtain a little bit. And talk about that fear, though. The fear that these other disciples had, since that faith hadn't quite come to fruition. So, have you ever been afraid? Have any of you out there been afraid to fly? There's this woman on a flight I took. She had the jitters. In fact, I had the jitters too because it was windy as fuck. And it wasn't her first flight. She'd never been able to relax while flying out of the plane. It didn't help that the flight that we were on had been delayed because of the mechanical problem. It didn't happen that the ride we had getting up into the sky felt like the plane was shaking apart. And people were like shocked and barking and, you know, and all that stuff. So she was already ready to piss herself. But when we got clear of all of it, when we got over the mountains and things started to settle down a little bit, the lights began flickering. Now, I'd already done my PTSD bit and passed the fuck out. And I had come to. And there she was. You know, now all of a sudden jittery because the lights flickered. And she was like, oh, shit. Something else is wrong with the plane. I should not have gotten on this flight. So she called the flight attendant. And the flight attendant came over and, you know, when she told her, I'll take care of it. And I was just kind of like, okay. So imagine this woman's surprise next to me when the lights just went the fuck out. It was kind of like in total darkness, except for like the couple of like emergency lights that they have. That attendant had solved the problem by just turning off the fucking lights. I mean, it was still daytime, so what the fuck? Anyway, the problem with me is I have way too much snark. So I kind of nudged her with a smirk and said, do me a favor. Don't mention anything on the flight to that flight attendant about a problem with the engines. You know, most of us realize that the fear of flying is irrational. Statistically, flying is one of the safest ways to travel, but lately things have made us a bit more nervous, like the invisible door flying off of that plane, or the landing gear falling off of planes, or all the other weird little bits and things. You know, watching the sheathing rip off of an engine from Southwest. I saw that on TikTok yesterday. It made me go, gee, what? But you know what? For some of us, it is a real and helpless feeling being thousands of feet up in the air, depending on a couple of motors and some science to keep us up there. And I remember growing up learning that one of the most best-known personalities in sports was terrified of flying. And that was Madden, John Madden. Now, he was this big, tough, former football player in the National Football League. He was also the Super Bowl-winning head coach of the Oakland Raiders when they were dirty and mean. And he was probably one of the most colorful sports commentators at NFL. Him and his stupid screen with the little white lines and scribblings all over it, and you can't make sense of them anyway. But one of the things he was best known for, especially among the football fans, was that video game, Madden NFL. But the dude was terrified of flying. In fact, he had a specially outfitted private bus to carry him from coast to coast for that football telecast. And that was the kind of bus he had to drive around his team to all the games. They never flew. Someone asked him why he was afraid to fly, and he confided that something had happened years ago at an airport.
See, airports used to have this machine where you could buy flight insurance just before you boarded the plane.
He said once he was standing in line at the insurance policy machine, he noticed there were three pilots ahead of him waiting to buy insurance as well. That's comforting, isn't it? Now, of course, you may be perfectly okay about flying, but there's other things that you're terrified of. Maybe it's cancer or Alzheimer's. Maybe it's losing your job or being deserted by your spouse. Maybe safety of your children, or the truly terrifying thing, spiders. What I'm trying to get at is that all of us know what it's like to be afraid, especially about spiders. Anyway, there was this funny dude named Dave Barry a long time ago. He did comics, I believe. He once put it that all of us are born with a set of instinctive fears. Fear of falling, dark lobsters, falling on lobsters in the dark. Fear and anxiety are part of living. That's what I'm getting at. Somewhere at any given moment, there's more than 2,000 thunderstorms occurring somewhere on Earth, and some of us are terrified of thunderstorms. But it's obvious thunderstorms are going to go on all the time, and it's inevitable sometime in your life, they're going to be right where you are. You can run, you can't hide. Fear is part of life. We live in a fearful age. In 1933, the inaugural address, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a fellow Episcopalian, he sought to calm the troubled America with throes of fear and depression by saying there's nothing to fear but fear itself. I call bullshit. I wonder what he would say today. Certainly there's nothing to be afraid of besides fear. Violence in schools, random mass murders that happen more than once a day, it seems. Terrorism. ISIS is coming back. They attacked Russia. I'm very conflicted about that, honestly. How about the deterioration of our environment? I read recently, well, not even recently, but I read at one point there was new things to worry about. You know, not only is COVID-19 still running rampant, but it was once believed that only the United States and Russia possessed the last vials containing smallpox. In 92, I remember this like it was yesterday, but in 92, a Soviet defector claimed that the Russians had weaponized smallpox and actually continued to produce up to 20 tons of it. Now, with all the turmoil from the former Soviet Union, there's this nagging fear of anyone from the 70s and 80s that, hey, a terrorist group's going to pay Russia just enough, especially now that they have, like, no money for anything. They're going to sell that shit to, like, ISIS or something, even though ISIS just blew them up. Hey, money's money. And we're going to end up with smallpox being very present today, again. In worse form, we're going to have COVID smallpox or some shit. And just remember, Vladimir Putin has his finger on that button, too. Ugh. So, it comes to that first thing, huh? The disciples of Jesus knew what it was to be afraid. Because on the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together, doors were locked in fear of the Jewish leaders. Their master had been crucified. They feared the same thing would happen to them. Even though there had been reports that he had been resurrected, they were still wrestling with what that meant. They remained in seclusion, except for Thomas, who was not in seclusion. And they were meeting under the cover of night, secretly, behind locked doors. They weren't even meeting. That's where they were staying. They were just like, nope, fuck you. We live in fear too sometimes, don't we? We lock ourselves away behind metaphorical doors. We might say that the disciples lacked faith, but let's put ourselves in their position real quick. It's hard. It hurts. We can do it.
They face imminent danger from the civic and religious authorities. They needed assurance that everything would be okay. It's something we can all understand. There are times we need it too. We'd like to think that the Easter Sunday solved all these disciples' fears and doubts, but clearly it didn't. Over the next 50 days after Easter until the day of Pentecost, the disciples struggled constantly to accept the reality of the resurrection. Experiencing new life that did not happen overnight, just as it often doesn't happen that way for us. But this is how the story continues. On the evening of that first day, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them. So in the middle of all that confusion, all that fear, all that angst and anxiety, their boy just shows up. The doors are locked. They still were locked. He just showed up and stood there with them. It shows them about the nature of his new resurrection, right? Walls weren't an obstacle. He didn't Hulk out or anything, but there was more to it than that. Jesus was able to come to us with his loving care. He was able to reach us behind the walls where we have hidden ourselves. He can dispel our fears. Meet us right at the point of our need. Piece of cake. Easy peasy lemon squeezy. In the midst of their fear and confusion, Jesus came. Now just hold on to that truth. You might be able to handle a lot more of life's anxieties. Dennis Guernsey wrote this book called If I'm So Free, How Come I Feel Boxed In? He talks about a psychologist who was watching a little girl come skipping out of church office on her way back to her classroom, and evidently, she had been sent on an errand by her day school teacher. She was reporting back to her class as ordered. Now, the distance from the church office to her classroom was about 100 feet. As she skipped, she chanted a little saying to keep herself in step. My mommy loves me, my daddy loves me, my teacher loves me, my grandma loves me, God loves me, Jesus loves me. According to Dennis, she felt loved. 100 feet worth of it, too. The psychologist watching her taking this journey commented, I wish my patients felt just 1/10 of the love she feels. What a difference it would make in their lives. It might be a good mantra for anyone who is about to succumb to the burden of that fear. God loves me. Jesus loves me. And nothing can pull us away from that love, folks. Walls can't do it, locked doors. Neither death nor life nor angels, principalities or things present. Nor things to come, nor powers, nor heights, no depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. That's what Paul wrote to the Romans. That's Romans chapter 8, verse, I think it's 2 verses, I think it's 38 and 39. Don't quote me, but you can check it. But I feel like what Paul wrote there is absolutely true. The most potent antidote to this fear is our faith in God. Ralph Turnbull, a Scottish writer, decades ago wrote about a harrowing story that took place during World War II. Because that was the first one. It was just after the armistice. I know the word armistice. Anyway, 1918, right? Yeah. There was a destroyer that carried the Prime Minister, Lord George, from France to England. And the weather during that crossing was kind of scary. When they reached Dover, The conditions were so bad, even in the harbor, that they could not get alongside the docks. So they sent a small motorboat called a launch to carry the Prime Minister to shore. But there was a problem. How to get him from the destroyer to the launch? Because the destroyer was rolling in a most terrifying way. And there was an honest danger of having him fall into the sea. So what they did was they put five men on the launch. The Prime Minister was led to the gangway. The officer in charge told him that at the word go, he was to step forward and release his hold. So he waited. The ship rolled down the next swell until the upper edge of the side of the boat was almost submerged. When the ship had reached the limit of her roll, the officer shouted, "Go!" And the Prime Minister stepped forward and let go. He fell directly into the small boat below and was caught as neatly and surely as if he were in a baseball. He was fucking caught, okay? I was going to make some sort of analogy to a baseball in the mid, but evidently my mouth said, "No, fuck you." But he was safe because he trusted the officer. There. I'm moving on. I can't imagine a more perfect picture, though, of faith than that, right? He was just like, cool, and went for it. Didn't hesitate or anything, just off he went. Catch! But you know, I'm going to try. E. Stanley Jones, doctor, probably one of the great Christians of the 20th century, he said, "I see that I am inwardly fashioned for faith and not for fear. Fear is not my native land, faith is. And I am so made that worry and anxiety are sand in the machinery of life. Faith is oil. I live better by faith and in confidence than by fear and doubt and anxiety. In anxiety and worry, my being is gasping for breath. These are not my native air. We do not know why it is that warriors die sooner than not. But it's a fact. But I, who am simple of mind, think I know," wrote Stanley Jones. "We are inwardly constructed in nerve and tissue and brain cell and soul for faith and not fear. God made us this way. To live by worry is to live against reality." It's kind of cool, isn't it? My back is so hot. God, leather seats suck in cars sometimes. So while the disciples were cowering behind locked doors, Jesus stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After this, he showed them the hands and side, and the disciples were overjoyed, says John. It wasn't his words, though, that reassured those disciples. It was his presence. It was knowing he was alive. Bill and Gloria Gaither, though, what did they write? "Because he lives, I can face tomorrow." And that's true of us all. We know within our hearts that our Redeemer lives, and we can walk with confidence regardless of our situation. Ooh, Elizabeth, was it Kubler? Maybe someone else will remember and make a comment. Let me know whether it's Kubler or Kumler. I can't remember. I mean, Ross, who was the closest thing we have to an expert on death and ministry to the dying, Miss Kubler-Ross, once showed a group of seminary students a drawing that a child had made. The child had terminal cancer but refused to talk to anyone, withdrawing behind a wall of silence. The only communication offered by this child was through his drawings. This particular drawing that she showed to the class had a beautiful little cottage set off to the side of the paper.
Above the cottage was a bright, brilliant sun. Surrounding the cottage, beautiful lawn, flowers, trees, and in front there was a family of four. Mother, father, and two kids at play. In the center of the paper, though, stood a tiny figure facing a large army tank, which was bearing down on him, about to run him down. Obviously, the tiny figure represented the dying child who saw himself helpless before a gigantic force that was about to destroy him. So Dr. Ross asked the group of students, how could you help this child communicate his fears? How could you offer him comfort? Two students answered that challenge. One student drew a picture of a figure holding the stop sign in front of the tank. But it did nothing to soothe the child when it was shown to him. However, the second seminarian drew another person in the picture. That person was doing nothing more, nothing less than simply standing by the little child who was facing a gigantic force, holding the hand of the child. And that broke the wall of silence, enabled this little child to finally pour out all of his pent-up feelings. All the little guy needed was to know someone was with him and that he wasn't alone. Yeah, on the first day of the week, when the disciples were together and the doors were locked to fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came, stood among them, and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed his hands aside, and the disciples were overjoyed when they saw him. Jesus. Why were they overjoyed? They knew they were no longer alone. That's why. Their situation still troubling, their lives still in danger, but they don't face it alone. Jesus is with them. That's really the good news. God is with us. Someone is beside us holding our hand, regardless of whatever force may be sent against us, we can prevail. Because Jesus is alive. He's not going to leave us be. Because he lives, we can face tomorrow. Because he lives, all fear is gone. And somewhere out there, Thomas is getting us tuna. So when we come back, maybe we should just call him Judas. Anyway, fuckers, if you made it this long, then you know how much I love you. You know how much I care. You know how much I miss doing this. And you know what? It felt really good to put that out there. So guess this means that later on today, I'm going to make the one for Sunday and make sure this gets off on the right foot, yeah? Also, if you want to go to my Ko-fi account and kind of like send a little bit of help my way, I'll start making some more content, sure. We need the money. We got too much shit going on and not enough money to afford it all. Gas, food, this is so expensive. Anyway, as always, I try and help everyone I can with whatever I receive. So I love you fuckers. Take care of each other. And remember, everyone's welcome. Jesus fucking Christ.